Hello, and a very warm welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated design show.
Today, we turn our editorial gaze back onto our own turf and consider how to cover a subject as diverse and delightful as design.
Everything from very serious intellectual pieces about the state of architecture to penises falling off teapots.
We ponder the future of print publishing, talk to the team behind one of the world's biggest architecture websites, and meet an art director auguring the future of editorial design.
All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24.
Henry Reece Sheridan, have we bitten off more than we can chew, turning the lens back on ourselves to talk about the very important subject of how people actually cover design on this week's show?
I don't think so, Josh. I think a degree of self-reflection is healthy in any organism, be it human or a radio show.
I do think it's interesting because it's something that we on the magazine side of the business think very, very carefully about. There's a dearth of people willing to invest in new print products. The print products that seem to be out there covering design are becoming more and more niche. And actually, I wonder sometimes if the journalism suffers. Lots of websites are out there getting hit after hit, click after click. But I wonder if advertisers really get the same engagement that they do if they put their wares into a magazine as a piece of advertising, or if they get a bit of really insightful coverage in print. Obviously, we're talking radio, a different medium. How do you see the lay of the land for covering design?
Well, I think no matter what field you're covering, we're in a turbulent media environment at the moment. And while we were putting the show together, one thing that my mind kept coming back to was the first panel of our recent Quality of Life conference in Vienna, which was called Let's Talk About It. It was all about communication. And what we talked about there a lot was this sweet spot, which is being negotiated at the moment, between more traditional analog forms of media and the digital stuff that saturated the media landscape for the last 10 years or so. There are people seeking out that analog experience again, the tactile experience. They want their mind to be focused by the physical parameters of a product. But digital still has a role, and the internet isn't going away, obviously.
And I think, we're trying not to be too anachronistic about this whole thing, but I think the idea is that you can't give away everything that you thought was sacred in favour of a new medium. So we talk a little bit later on with the team behind Arc Daily, a remarkably successful website that I think you and I find interesting because they're trying to be a resource for professionals as well as being someone that disseminates information. But we kick off today's show by talking to a magazine editor named Katie Tregeddon, and we asked her to take the lie of the land by picking up a few independent publishing titles to see exactly how design is being covered on the newsstand today.
I've been into the Mag Culture shop and spent far too much money this morning.
Talking to our mutual friend Jeremy Leslie about his beautiful booty of magazines.
Indeed. And I've got in front of me a kind of broad selection of magazines, each of which I think does something quite different. One is a brand new magazine called Ordinary.
It's very red, isn't it? There's a few things going on.
This is a really exciting magazine. We're talking about design coverage, and I'm particularly interested in products and furniture design. I think what people tend to forget is that every man-made product has been designed. So this magazine has a little plastic bag on the front with a plastic knife, fork and spoon in it.
It looks like it's been left there by someone who's had lunch next to the magazine and it's on and it's on top. But tell me why you think this is interesting, other than it being eye-catching.
Well, I think this is really interesting because this magazine has taken this product, this piece of product design, as its inspiration, and given those products to 21 different artists, and each spread in the magazine is an artist's response to those products. There's not a single word in this magazine. It is just artistic response to knife, fork and spoon after artistic response to knife, fork and spoon.
I've been hoping Monocle would actually do something very similar to that. I could take a week or two off. It would be nice.
Yeah, I was chatting to the editor of Modern Design Review and we were saying, God, the sub-editing on this.
You know, we were talking a little bit before we came on the show about how probably the trajectory of covering design for most commentators in the industry is quite tough as print budgets are cut. You mentioned Sunday supplements here in the UK don't see the advertising potential of writing about design, and therefore it's declining. But I wonder what you think about the trajectory of the industry.
I think there's a really interesting sort of movement going on at the moment. We keep hearing print is dead, print is dead. And I think for certainly the mainstream publishing model is struggling. As you say, the design sections in Sunday supplement magazines are getting smaller and smaller. There are big interior design magazines folding by the day. It's getting harder and harder to pitch design stories as a freelance journalist, which is the other thing that I do, into sort of mainstream press. But what I think is really interesting is there's definitely still an appetite for coverage of design. And so there's a whole crop of independent magazines popping up to fill that space, I suppose. But what's different about them is they're able to be a lot more brave slash stupid. And that's the thing I love about that magazine. You'd never see a big magazine that had to answer to shareholders and advertisers and all that sort of things getting away with what Ordinary is getting away with.
So perhaps we're missing a little bit of that analytical overview in terms of publishing, but what we're getting is a lot of creativity. Would you agree with that?
I think there's analytical overview as well. What I think is interesting about these independent magazines is they all have a really distinct voice and they all have a really clear niche. Whereas I think traditionally magazines appealed to a much broader audience. So you'd look at their audience demographics and they'd be something like females 25 to 45 based in the southeast of England. Now people are making magazines that appeal to much tighter audiences. So Modern Design Review, which is another magazine I think is really interesting, only writes about product and furniture design. It doesn't write about architecture. It doesn't write about interior design. It doesn't write about art or photography. It's very, very focused in what it does. And that means, although it appeals to a smaller audience, it really, really appeals to that audience.
And you've lugged all of this finely tuned print to Midori House, so we should probably take a look through another one. I can see Disegno over there, which is an interesting title. It's the 10th edition. I'm not sure they always hit their print run. I might be being slanderous here, but I don't think they quite work every quarter or they go every quarter.
Well, it's just gone quarterly. It was biannual,
and this is the first quarterly issue.
Yeah.
I remember picking up issue one, and issue one was a beautiful kind of, there was a little bit of foil on the cover. It was a really matte stock, very thick.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing piece of print. It's a beautifully designed item in itself. And if my memory serves me correctly, it lends itself to a kind of a bit more of a long form, a bit more of an academic kind of arched eyebrow look at design.
And I think it's really interesting. Apparently, Johanna Argerman-Ross, editor of Disegno, sat in this very room and told Tyler Brûlé that she would never go quarterly. And here is the first quarterly edition of Disegno.
Well, we don't like to gloat. And also her husband's magazine, Jocks and Nerds, is also a wonderful, wonderful print publication.
Yeah,
so we're
absolutely
supporters.
I mean, absolutely. I've been a fan of Disegno since issue one, and I have that very copy in my studio. But what I love about them is they're very much champion long form. And again, that's something else that people keep talking about in the age of digital: long form content is dead. Their shortest essays are 4,000 words long. I think with going quarterly, they're bringing in some more short form content so they can be a bit more responsive to sort of current news. But what they do really well is deep analysis of what's going on in design. So they kind of steer away from that more surface level sort of news reporting and more look at what's going on in depth in the industry. And they give themselves plenty of space and plenty of time to explore issues in depth, which again seems counter to what everybody's telling us about what's happening in the publishing industry. So I think that's a really interesting example.
What is the effect on young designers, people who are given a bit of a leg up by these independent publishers, when basically the power to disseminate information is held by more people, lots of smaller magazines, rather than a singular voice that everyone goes to for all of their design news? Do you think that gives some freedom to smaller designers, or does it make it harder for them because there are so many competing voices rather than a single critic that makes or breaks you?
I think the difference is made is huge. So the big thing that a lot of the big magazines work on very long lead times, and they will want things to be in their magazine as they're happening. So for example, when they're covering design shows, they will have written about those design shows long before the design show actually happened, which means a lot of their content's driven by press releases, by relationships with PR agencies. And new designers just don't have access to photography of that quality, to PR representation. A lot of them don't know what a press release is. So they haven't got a hope of getting coverage in those big magazines. What's interesting about a lot of these independent publications is they're bucking some of the trends. So, for example, the coverage of Milan in Fiera won't come out until June, which seems really stupid because everybody's talking about Milan now. But it's really important to me that I'm writing about things I've actually seen and I've spoken to the designers and I've sat in their chairs. I think the kind of bravery of independent magazines to do something slightly different and go against some of those established rules of publishing enables them to cover new designers in a way that the mainstream media just aren't able to.
I couldn't agree anymore. Actually, I should disclose to listeners that we ran into one another in Milan at the Airbnb breakfast near the Rosanna Orlandi shop. And you're obviously working on Fiera. I was obviously feverishly putting together Monocle's picks. But actually, you know, all of the things that before I'd been to Milan, I'd looked at in the newspapers, were some of the biggest disappointments, right? Mm. The people with the biggest PR machines who have done an installation, which probably cost them a lot of money. And it just, you know, there wasn't that much there. So I do agree with you that the metabolism of a magazine that's willing to make people wait for responsible coverage of things is in the industry very much desired. Okay, so what have we got in front of us still? We've still got a few pages to thumb
through. Dirty Furniture is a really interesting publication. So they, when they launched, said there will only ever be 6 magazines. So they have what they call a built-in death date, which I think is fascinating. And each magazine covers one piece of furniture. So issue 1 covered the sofa, and I've got in front of me issue 2, which covers the table.
So for people that can't see it, it's kind of a lavender, slightly glossy, small bound, thick, kind of, it looks like kind of paperback stock, right?
Yep. Yeah. And their strapline is when design leaves the showroom. So they're not talking about new product launches. They're talking about the role of the table in society. So there's everything in here, stories about poker, stories about war tables, stories about the telephone table, which no longer exists in the age of digital. The stories about kind of meal times and how those are changing. They've got some recipes from 1979's House and Garden.
Perfect.
And it's just this lovely kind of analysis of actually what a table is, what it's for, what it means. I think people so often forget when they're writing about design that these are not pieces of art. You know, we look at showrooms with little signs saying, do not sit on this chair, and we walk around train fares where things are elevated up on plinths. Whereas actually that's not what design is. Design is supposed to be used. It's supposed to be a part of our lives. It's supposed to get dirty. It's supposed to be broken and kind of used until its last moment. And I think what Dirty Furniture do is kind of look into actually the use of these objects, which I think is a really fascinating angle and really differentiates them from a lot of the other design press.
And what else have we got there? You're not passing these over to me, so
sorry.
I don't feel like I'm getting the full joy of the printed
page. I'm happy with my new acquisitions.
You've done wonderfully here when tasked to find new design tasks. And actually, it's amazing that so many of these things are on the shelf that obviously we'll put in a plug for Jeremy Leslie's Mag Culture Shop here in London. But the fact that you can go to a newsstand and you can pick up 7 different titles that are all about design is surely a heartening thing for people in the print industry.
Yeah, and I think it's all part of this independent publishing movement. I mean, a lot of these magazines, we should probably caveat all of this with, a lot of these magazines are passion projects. So a lot of these magazines are not hugely profitable. A lot of them are a way of people demonstrating what they can do. So a lot of businesses run in that they have a magazine and then they have a content production studio, and the magazine is almost the front window for the content production studio. But it just means they're produced as a labour of love. And one of the things that I think is interesting about Modern Design Review is Laura Housley doesn't have an editorial schedule. So she publishes a magazine when she feels she's got enough to say and when she feels that magazine is finished. So it's not biannual or quarterly. It's whenever Laura feels the next one's ready. And I just think there's something lovely about that. There's something sort of generous and slightly gratuitous. But she says they love making magazines, and so they allow themselves to enjoy the process of making magazines rather than letting it become this deadline-driven, stressful sort of process.
So I'm going to give you time for one more. You have to pick one of the two magazines.
Okay, I'm going to talk about Pinup, because I think this is a brilliant magazine. I've only discovered it very recently. Architectural coverage is often very, very academic, very dry. You sort of need a degree in architecture to understand an article about architecture.
Very impressionistic, very over the top, lots of very kind of industry.
Taking itself very seriously.
Words.
Yeah. And what I love about this magazine, the strapline is Magazine for Architectural Entertainment. And there is everything in here from a Shakespeare quote to, I have to read this to you if I can find it. Since I started making phallic teapots, the factory sometimes calls me to say the penis is falling off.
I mean, this of the teapot, presumably.
Of the teapot. And this is from an interview with Pedro Freidenberg. But I mean, this is not a magazine that takes itself seriously. It's hilarious. It's full of kind of crazy graphic design, brilliant images, everything from very serious intellectual pieces about the state of architecture to penises falling off teapots. And it's very refreshing.
Well, it's quite funny, isn't it? People often associate magazines with having to be a little bit more conservative, especially in this era of kind of straitened times for raising ad revenues and stuff. But actually, it's good to see that people can be irreverent, people can be opinionated, they can have an editorial line and not just have to do that because digital is cheap and that's the place where they can do it and it can be a folly.
Yeah, I think it's really lovely to see people with a really strong voice and a really clear sense of why their magazine exists and who it's for, having the freedom, because they're not answerable to sort of shareholders and advertisers and all of those things that constrain the mainstream press. You know, and often these things are loss-making, so there's a lot of reason the mainstream press is the way it is and is successful. But I think it's really lovely to see people have that sort of creative freedom to create something like Ordinary, which is the most insane magazine I've ever seen.
Is it anachronistic? Is it a labour of love that people are going to have to fund if they want to do? Or do you think there's a future for it?
I think there's a future for it. I'm a big believer in niche. If you make something that's supposed to be for everybody, everybody will, you know, kind of like it. Whereas if you make something that's absolutely for a small group of people, those people are going to have it. you know, but that said, there are lots of different ways of funding magazines. It's not always just through the cover price. It might be that, as we've talked about, there are different business models that sit behind these publications. And I think that's quite exciting. I think it's interesting to see different ways of bringing things to market.
That was design journalist Katie Tregidden. Now, Josh, it's no secret that we've got a soft spot for print at Monocle. We have, after all, been in the magazine game ourselves for almost a decade now. But many titles are feeling the pressure of cheaper online competitors, even if those competitors aren't always as profitable as they seem.
Since starting in 2008, Arc Daily has become one of the world's most visited architecture websites. It's gone beyond simply replicating the content of a print publication and doing so online, and become an engine for debate, news, opinion, and insight among professionals and aficionados alike. It's also a growing practical resource for people in the field.
Founder and editor-in-chief David Basalto and European editor-at-large James Taylor Foster, who's also a regular Monocle 24 contributor, joined us in the studio to discuss how they got here and how to sustain their success. Do you just want to begin by telling me when and how Arc Daily started and what gap in terms of architecture and design coverage that you were looking to fill with it?
Well, this break started in 2006, actually under the name of Plataforma Urbana, an urbanism platform in Spanish, in Chile, because at that time we were seeing new media appear. It was the time when Web 2.0 offered you the possibility to be your own media, to create a blog, that you could do it on your own. You didn't require like highly technical skills. And the other David, the co-founder, he was just coming back from Europe where he was seeing that people were very into discussing the future of cities. He was coming from Barcelona, where he saw this big exhibit with all the projects that were going to be built in the next 5 years. And the general population will go to this exhibit in the right in the city center and will see, oh, near my house, they're going to build this phallic tower. Let's discuss that. This is the Akbar Tower by Jean Nouvel. And people had a stance on it. They had an opinion and they would comment about it. In Chile, what was happening? In Chile, people will only be talking about soccer players and their wives. In Chile, there were being very big urban projects in the works, like the tallest tower in South America. The transportation system was changing like very, very strong. And people were not discussing about these things. So he had this idea that people should be talking about this, and he knew that this had to do with the media. What if we would make a publication in which we could publish all these case studies, like the same of a magazine, but in a spread way, like not just focus on issues, like each article is a building, and we, thanks to the flexibility of the web, we can publish all the information that we want. We shouldn't restrict ourselves to 5 photos and 2 pages. We can publish all the details, what the architect was thinking about that, a video, his references, his sketches. And that's the way it started. It started in a way very instinctively, something that we, in a way, needed. And we started to do it through the web for others. And as it started to pick an audience, people started to share it. Like a viral growth, we saw that this had potential and we stick to it. And until today, that's the main core of, Arts Daily now in English, that it is to provide architects with access to information in an decentralized, free, open way.
James, David mentions that one of the motivating factors for establishing Arc Daily in the first place was this hunger for fresh information. Architecture journals, you know, where David was in Chile, were difficult to come by, at least the newest versions of them. But it's also true that, in general, these publications have a relatively slow metabolism anyway. Now, Arc Daily has an extremely fast metabolism. I believe that you publish a new post every half hour. Is that correct?
Well, almost. It's an endless stream. And I think the criticism that is often laid upon media like this is that it's almost like a data deluge. It's just an incessant stream of media that's difficult to kind of grasp and access and digest. But at the same time, I think it's important, as David was just mentioning, it's all in its infancy. You know, 2006 was the year in which Twitter was launched. 2006 was the year in which Facebook opened registration to the rest of the world. And I think it's almost, in some respects, an experiment. What is clear is that people want it, people enjoy it, and people are reading it, you know, now in multiple languages. And being able to provide this kind of open, democratic stream of information as quickly as possible, providing knowledge and tools and information to not only people in Europe and the Americas, but in like the developing world, in India, in Russia, in places where people are building extremely quickly and extremely fastly and urban centers are growing exponentially. I think this is where it is most important.
You know, you mentioned that ARC Daily provides a huge amount of information and resources for free. How have you monetized the website and turned it into a viable business?
Well, when we started this project, we were young, teaching at university, and this project didn't have a business model yet, so we had to live from something. And at the beginning, we were building. We were working on master plans in Chilean cities and districts and also doing office interiors. And during that process, we found that to have access to the right specifications of the architectural products that you saw on the projects that inspire you was very important. We were looking at references for things that we wanted to do to understand how to deal with this wall detail, this ceiling, and spending countless hours on the phone calling manufacturers or visiting their showrooms all around the city. We would spend one whole day just looking at curtain samples in different showrooms. So we said something that would be very helpful for us would be to have access to the products that we're seeing on the projects. So as we had a vast audience of architects, we understood that our platform could be of interest for people who wanted to reach architects, and this is the product manufacturers. So we understood that we could create a model that was not traditional advertising, not just banners, not what you see in architectural magazines where you see this girl taking a shower to promote a faucet. We could actually show you the faucet, its characteristics, how you specify it, and create a link with the manufacturer to get a quote, which for you as an architect during the creative specification process is very important. So that's how we came up with our material section that started in Chile, and now it's available in many markets, Brazil, Colombia, Peru, and recently in the U.S. So at the end, it's so related to what we wanted to do, knowledge. But this is technical knowledge that as an architect, you really need. So in a way, we found out a business model that could be a win-win for the architect who has a necessity for this technical knowledge, and for the manufacturers who want to reach the architect to expose his products. So this is what funds are daily. Probably in the rest of the world, you will see like Google Ads or things like that. But in the markets that were present, you are going to be exposed only to architectural products in relation to the projects that you are looking at.
That was ARC Daily's editor-in-chief, David Basulto, and European editor-at-large, James Taylor Foster.
Still to come on the show, we talk to art director Francesco Franchi about the future of editorial design itself.
Tall Stories is a new 5-minute audio snack from the team who bring you The Urbanist each week. In just a few minutes, we talk about one building, one statue, one park bench that has an interesting backstory, something special to reveal to us about life in the city in all shapes and sizes. Sometimes we'll get all historical on you, other times we might be yearning for modernity, but it's 5 minutes of urban diversion, an unplanned journey down the secret side streets of metropolitan life that will, we hope, keep you intrigued. Available every Monday, you can get it by subscribing to The Urbanist via monocle.com, SoundCloud, or iTunes. Be a part of the story.
It's hard to be sure how the way we cover design will change, be it online, on the radio, or in the time-tested pages of a glossy print piece. But regardless of the medium, editorial design itself will affect how we consume the information.
The art director and award-winning editorial and infographic designer Francesco Franchi, the man behind a handsome Gestalten-printed book named Designing News, spoke to me over the phone from Italy about how changing conditions have opened up new opportunities for graphic designers.
I think that this is one of the most interesting and ambitious times for a designer to be working in the newspaper market, because all the publishers are going to rethink their strategies, are trying to reinventing or finding new solutions. For example, what I'm looking now is from one side there is a sort of new independent magazine that are popping up everywhere. So dozens of good quality small magazines that are beautiful to look at, lovely to feel, to own. And on the other side, I'm looking at that there is also a new retail model. So if you are a designer working in a newspaper, you have to think also about the brand of your magazine, of your newspaper, because as we can see, The Guardian did, Monocle did. So newspaper and magazine are opening shops, are opening bar and coffee. You can order a cappuccino, but you can also order a newspaper from all over the world, or you can read a magazine, read an independent magazine or a glam or fashion magazine. And another important aspect for a designer is that nowadays big newspaper companies, but also magazines, are developing a sort of branded content studio inside of their newsroom. So they are producing content for other brands, and they are producing content with the same quality for the magazine. So working with the journalistic staff to develop this sort of branded journalism, but also working with the design to convey the value of the other brand, but in the language of their own magazine.
And it might be nostalgia, but often we look back at old magazine covers from maybe the 60s or 70s. We look at the bold advertising and we think to ourselves of a kind of golden age. That term, golden age, has been applied in some senses to the mini publishing boom, the small kind of crop of independent magazines that are coming out at this point. But do you think we're heading for another golden age of printing, or are things much more stratified? Is it much more small scale now?
No, I think it's a sort of golden age of for magazine because, for example, internet gives to all these small magazine or this new independent publishing initiative possibility to be distributed, to be known all around the world. So I think that also that this new golden age of magazine has to thanks also the web and the new way of distribution because we can see there are a lot of blogs and websites for people who loves a lot of magazine. But also I'm thinking about all the new retail model like the Mac Culture Shops in London where you can find a lot of magazine. So I think this is a real golden age of for magazine.
Art director Francesco Franchi there telling us about the challenges and opportunities in the landscape of editorial design.
And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My thanks to our editor Alex Funnell and Henry Rhys Sheridan. Don't spare your slings and arrows. Why not drop them a note at hrs@monocle.com?
Remember, we're back next week at the same time. And you can always listen again or dip into our back catalogue at monocle.com, SoundCloud and iTunes. And please do leave us a review while you're there. You've been listening to Section D. I'm Henry Rhys Sheridan.
And I'm Josh Bennett. And until next time, thanks for tuning in and goodbye.